We need to empower children to see themselves as having control over their own narrative and their own life, which means giving them the ability to own their own identity. And what that means on the blockchain is being able to own their own data. That in itself is so powerful from a psychological perspective, in terms of being able to also, through metacognition, being able to analyze, who am I? What is important to me? How do I learn? And then being able to own that just in itself, even if they do nothing else with it except for that process, I think will be incredibly impactful.
Hello, and welcome back to the Women of Web3 podcast. I'm Lauren Ingram, and I'm the founder of Women of Web3. We're a community and a consultancy, and we've been educating thousands of women about Web3 and sharing jobs, events, and learning resources like this podcast. In every episode, I'll be interviewing an incredible leader about their learnings. We start off by breaking down the Web3 jargon, then we head deeper down the rabbit hole. Please do subscribe and give us a rating. It really helps more people find the podcast. Now, you're probably listening to this podcast because you want to learn about Web3, but have you ever considered how to actually use it in your job? At MDRX, they build digital products using Web3, blockchain, machine learning, and AI, but with purpose as the foundation, never just tech for tech's sake. So why not download their cheat sheet? It's packed with top tips on why your business should give a damn about Web3 and see whether Web3 is actually right for you in your job, your business, or even your career. So whether you're looking to optimize your business strategy or leverage tech to stay ahead of the competition, MDRX have got you covered. I'm really excited to be working with them because they live and breathe Web3, and I love that they see tech as an enabler and not as the end goal. And because they're the tech consultancy arm of law firm Mishcon de Rea Group, they know everything there is to know about the legalities of Web3. And if you've ever tried to launch a legally compliant NFT project, DAO, anything like that, you'll know it's really complex and you need a trusted partner. Go and download their cheat sheet now by clicking on the link in the description. Today, I'm really happy to be joined by Amanda Slavin. She's someone that I met on a Zoom call a few months back, and I felt like we instantly connected because of both being mums in the Web3 space. And since then, I've learned that she's this incredible entrepreneur and thinker. She's almost like this wacky scientist, almost like the Oracle in the Matrix. I think you're going to see what I mean in the interview. She's an educator by background. She then started running small-scale inspirational events in Las Vegas with Tony Hsieh, who's the co-founder and CEO of Zappos, which later sold to Amazon. That work morphed into an agency called Catalyst Creative, and Amanda used her thesis paper about seven levels of engagement to develop her own framework called The Seventh Level. She's got a best-selling book of the same name, and she's now combining education and the sort of creative thread and Web3 in her new stealth startup, which we're going to learn about today. And she's also part of several DAOs, and she's an advisor to multiple startups. I actually think I'm going to need to get her on the podcast twice because she's got so many wild stories. She's like somebody twice her age. So without further ado, here is Amanda. Welcome to the show, Amanda. Can you start off by saying who you are and what you do?
Sure. My name is Amanda Slavin, and I am an entrepreneur of multiple businesses, which I'm sure I'll, you know, jump into later. The author of a book called The Seventh Level. I have a master's in curriculum and instruction, so I consider myself still an educator. And my most recent project is in stealth mode, which is why I'm not kind of using that as a title. And I know I'll be talking about that, but I'm a co-founder of a creative agency called Catalyst Creative and a learning platform called Catalyst U. And I'm an advisor and as well as an investor to about 20 startups.
Yeah, I saw that on your LinkedIn. I didn't realize that you've got your fingers in a lot of pies.
I do. I'm full. I'm very full from those pies. Yes. When I transitioned out of being CEO of Catalyst Creative after 10 years, I really wanted, and this was during COVID, I had a new baby. I wanted to explore working more with startups because within an agency, you have to work with a lot of corporate clients that could pay the bills. And startups tend to not be able to afford, you know, agency services, at least in the beginning. So I just started working for equity shares and wanting to get my hands really dirty in the pies, if you will. And so I started working with quite a few startups. One of my HubSpot, it's actually a global company, is one of my favorite companies that I'm an advisor of. But I finally took some off my plate after literally being on 20 advisory boards and then having another baby and saying, I'm good. I think I need to slow down a bit.
I've only met you once before and you had a lot of crazy stories then. And I feel like there's going to be a whole new batch of them this time.
I'm trying to be succinct so it's not too crazy because it could be 2 hours of a podcast if I really go.
Well, that's the thing. You keep telling me interesting things. I want to ask you briefly, how did you end up getting on all these boards? Did you just kind of approach these companies and say, love what you're doing, here's what my background is, here's how I can offer value?
Yes and no. Well, you know, I started my my creative agency in 2012. And the intention there was to utilize my framework that I wrote my thesis on when I was getting my master's in education in marketing and in, you know, increasing engagement within employee environments, within, you know, experiential design, within social media campaigns, within, you know, again, websites, anything that touched a customer, I wanted to change. I wanted to transform that relationship between company and customer to be meaningful and not just transactional. And so I did that for, you know, Google and NPR and Dell and, you know, the NFL, ESPN, et cetera. And also quite a few nonprofits and startups. But in that time frame, what I realized was I was only touching a very specific problem that was being brought to me, but I actually wasn't able to touch all of the other problems that caused that problem. So I called it like brand acupuncture. Someone would come to me and say, we need Instagram followers. But then when I really looked at their brand, it was nothing to do with Instagram. It had everything to do with the fact that they didn't even know who their audience was. And I wasn't able to touch that part of it. And so, or I would look at their brand and be like, you don't even have the right team and you're not communicating to your team effectively. So you don't have the right organizational structure, but I wasn't able to touch that. And the other problem was that I was adding so much value to these startups because I was doing this quote unquote agency work, which was service-based work. And then they were continuing to grow and to expand, but I wasn't able to touch on that success because it was just a short transaction, which is not the way that I think about relationships. So I started taking equity plus cash while I was the CEO of the agency. And then once I transitioned out of CEO, a lot of the startups that had continued to, like, you know, reach out to me to work with me, I'm also an angel investor. So they would reach out to me for angel investment. And I would say no, but I'll take advisory shares. And somehow that just continued to work out. And they said, yes, we need your support and your help. So sometimes I would do strategic angel plus advisory. Sometimes I would just do advisory, but it was finally the opportunity to have a long-term meaningful relationship with these startups to support them on all aspects of their growth, not just one.
So that's how you got all your fingers in all the pies.
Exactly.
I wanted to ask you first about your sort of career so far. And I'm going to ask you about the 7 levels of engagement and then come on to what your involvement is in Web3. So you've talked about how you've sort of combined your background as an educator and then bringing that together with brand engagement. I know you told me over a long lunch about these amazing events that you used to run and then that sort of became Catalyst Creative. It sounded very cool. I wish I could have been at those events. Tell me how that came together.
So I met Tony Hsieh. I was a teacher and then I was in nightlife and hospitality opening restaurants. And then I was producing conferences and experiences like TEDx's Summit Series and at Summit Series, World Economic Forum, young Global Shapers. At Summit Series, I met Tony Hsieh, who was the CEO of Zappos. And I know that might be a longer story to be told, but I will go very quickly to the answer of the question that you asked me, which is that I then ended up starting a business with him. And the business's intention was to work as a part of his $350 million revitalization project in downtown Vegas. He had just gotten acquired by Amazon. Zappos had been acquired by Amazon, and he wanted to buy 18 city blocks around Zappos in terms of the campus and expand the campus, not make it insular, but make it a part of a city, more like an NYU than like a traditional Apple or a Nike campus. And so as a part of that initiative, I started to create experiences that were not insular, like a Summit or like a TED, you know, really, which I felt were incredible, but very much for the 1%. I wanted to democratize that inspiration for the 99%. And in Las Vegas, it's the 50th worst education system in the country. So we started throwing experiences starting once a month, and then it expanded to twice a month, where two times a month, 50 entrepreneurs, thought leaders, creatives, actors, I mean, really incredible individuals from all over the world would come to downtown Vegas for 3 days. We would immerse them into downtown Vegas. They would act like locals, if you will. They would live in an apartment and they would come learn about the project and then give talks and workshops free to the public. So we brought 2,000 of these individuals, provided around 300 free talks and workshops. And this was everyone from the co-CEO of Whole Foods to Simon Sinek to, you know, Sean Stevenson, who, if you don't know Sean Stevenson, you should definitely look up Sean Stevenson. We also every month had different themes. So some months we actually had themes around, you know, women empowerment, and we would have, you know, the co-founder of Away or Warby Parker, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So anyway, we did that for 2.5 years, and then that snowballed into an agency because people would come, be super impacted, be super inspired, and say, "How do you do this for us?"
Wow, doing a 3-day event of 2,000 people. How did you fund that?
So 3 days, 50 people each event. Twice a month for 2.5 years. I should notate that 2,000 people total. That doesn't mean that it's actually less work. I think it's actually more work because we also did large scale events like you know, music festivals and, you know, working with Coca-Cola, et cetera. But in this case, these 50 people were completely immersed, and it was two times. It was back to back every single month. So try just imagining trying to find 50 people that would, they had to fly themselves there. Everything else was paid for, to come to downtown Vegas. These are busy people, to be able to then give talks and free, completely free, because we didn't pay them. Mm. It was funded through first Tony, because his vision was to create more serendipity, more collisions, more connectivity within downtown Vegas. And we wanted to provide the opportunities to those who have moved to Vegas that they would get in New York or San Francisco or London. So he funded it. And then what we started doing was, as I mentioned, there were different themes per month. We started finding co-curating partners that would not only, you know, sponsor it, but bring people as well that they wanted to, whether it was their employees or their clients, you know, customers, et cetera, that they could immerse within this experience around a theme that was meaningful to them. So like Indiegogo was a partner. They were like a Kickstarter, and they brought a lot of the actual clients that had raised money on the platform. And it was all around, you know, utilizing a crowd to be able to raise money. And that entire week was around giving talks and workshops to the public, to entrepreneurs that were looking to create new ideas, et cetera, et cetera. But the way that the business actually grew was not by any of those things. It was that people would come, like, you know, the head of EcoCycle, which was the recycling program of Coca-Cola. He would attend and he would say, "This is so impactful. I need you to do this for my brand," or from Dell, or again, from NPR. You know, NPR was building a millennial arm for National Public Radio. It's a big American brand. And they said, "How do you build community for us in a similar way?" So that's really the way the business grew. Was it actually grew 77% in the first year, because this was a business development machine. It was our branding, our experience. We weren't funding it. It was all about just bringing people into this funnel, inspiring them to think differently about their own lives and meet incredible people as a part of the event. And then them saying, "Please do this for us." And so then we were able to replicate it through agency model.
Wow. Like I say, I wish I could have been part of those. They sound genuinely really inspiring. And as I say, when I've heard about it from you previously, it sounded like a really special time. And I can see why you were able to grow a business off the back of it and why people wanted to tap into that. Sounds a little bit similar to something in the UK actually called the Do Lectures. I'm guessing you will know them.
No.
You're not making a face of knowing them.
I will look them up.
But I know that one of my questions was about Tony. Are you up for talking more about him?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
So talking briefly again about Tony, who passed away a couple of years ago, it sounds like he was a really inspirational person in your life, especially where he built his business as well, in terms of what you described to me previously around how people could almost sort of sell between teams and things.
Tony passed away 2 years ago, and he was a futurist in every aspect of that word. He saw things 20 years ahead. And I remember when he was working on Downtown Project and revitalizing downtown Vegas and thinking really strategically about changing the way that, you know, around serendipity and these collisions and return on luck, he called it. I asked him if he was afraid to fail. And he told me that everyone thought he was crazy when he was selling shoes online, because there was no such thing as selling shoes online. Like, they would say, "Well, I have to try it on in the store. And what if I had for a turn in?" And, you know, it obviously the world caught up with that, because so many businesses replicated his customer service strategy and his corporate culture strategy. So he was obsessed with corporate culture. So 10 years ago, he was really doing a lot of research on the impact of when cities grow in density, they grow in creativity. As corporations grow in density, they decrease in creativity. And so he wanted to make Zappos more like a city. And so his intention was to create, you know, he always talked about how, like, New York City never runs out of food, or there's no CEO of a rainforest. Like, these are self-organized models where things just operate because everyone has a role. Everyone knows their accountabilities, and everyone just operates from that place, more like ants or bees. And so he was creating Zappos into a self-organized system. And this was literally in 2012. It was called Holacracy. And then this is a whole other podcast, but then he did a series of other experiences from Holacracy, which is then something called Teal, which is reinventing organizations. These are all just books that people can read. And then he went into something called Market-Based Dynamics. And what that was he was turning Zappos into a marketplace. Think of it like the biggest agency, where first of all, he broke down the hierarchy of, this is no longer a triangle, it's circles. As I just said, like, based on roles and accountabilities, everyone knew the jobs that they were supposed to have and they were supposed to do. He created an infrastructure as a part of Holacracy, which is that anyone could propose how to move the organization forward. Anyone could propose, this is literally now DAO systems, which we could certainly talk about, but anyone could propose, okay, this is something that I want to do to improve this organization of Zappos, wherever they were, whatever position they were in. And there was a structure and infrastructure in place to ensure that those, initiatives did not move the organization backwards, but forwards. And then what he did was those circles became entities where as long as they managed their P&L, you know, their profit and losses, they were then able to, and they serviced each other. So the events circle would service the website circle, which would service the, you know, operations circle and so on and so on. They could then service external clients and then keep the money to do with whatever they wanted. So if they wanted to do a retreat, or if they wanted to pay themselves bonuses, or if they wanted to create a whole new event series within Zappos, it was possible and feasible because it was their money once they managed their P&L. So that was completely revolutionary. And he had something called micro-credentialing, where there was literally job boards within Zappos where people could just learn and then be able to take on more work. He was designing a Web3 environment, a decentralized way of being able to create autonomous individuals with an organization that felt confident, that felt heard, that felt seen, that felt a part of it. It was a little bit early. I think he was, again, talking about things that he knew would eventually make sense to everyone. But at the time, everyone was like, what are you doing? Why are you doing this? Doesn't make any sense. But that's what I learned from him. I studied under him. I was trained in Holacracy. I implemented a lot of the organizational structures within Zappos. I measured engagement and how it impacted engagement within Zappos as well. So that was the thing I was most passionate about when working collaboratively with him. He was an amazing and zany and totally out there guy. He made sense to know. One, but he made sense to me.
Well, thank you for sharing that. And was he part of the inspiration for you sort of diving headlong into Web3 now?
He 100% was the inspiration. In the beginning of Web3, I felt it was very FOMO-based, scarcity-based, a little bit very much like, you know, again, you have to buy this, you have to get this. And that to me is, I'm kind of allergic to that because I was in nightlife and hospitality. And I feel that as a marketing ploy is not the way that I like to operate or like to think. Because again, my marketing strategies are from education, not from traditional marketing. So I was like, I need a minute. And then my husband actually was the one who just kept telling me about Web3 and sending me information. And then I started to see people on LinkedIn that I had worked with Tony, starting to post things and share things. And I said, okay, wait, let me look into this. And then when I started to learn about this, I was like, I really was blown away. I was like, this is exactly what Tony was doing. Exactly. All of the things I learned from him, all of the things I implemented in a real corporate environment, like a real use case in the Web2 world, I saw the change, the profound impacts that it could have. So yes, it was 100%. He was like coming back. He was speaking to me from the other realm and being like, told you, told you so, Amanda. So that's it, absolutely the reason why I was very excited about the potential.
So do tell me about what you're doing in Web3 now. I know you say you're in stealth mode, but what are you able to tell me?
What I am working on is utilizing my framework, which I can just briefly touch, but I don't need to go through every single level of engagement. But my framework is called the 7th level of engagement. And the process is really being able to identify that a person is, that engagement is not binary. It's not disengaged or engaged. It's this nuanced fashion to understanding where a person is within these 7 levels of engagement, reaching them where they are, and then being able to develop, you know, engagement interventions, if you will, to be able to pull them up to these higher levels of engagement. So the bottom 3 levels are what stands in the way of connection or engagement. The middle levels are around kind of foundational building blocks of that building a relationship with someone. And those higher levels are around delighting, a sense of passion and purpose. So, and the levels can be applied in education, in a workplace, in marketing, et cetera. So I have utilized these levels, as I mentioned, first in a classroom environment, getting my master's in education, testing out what it looked like to measure engagement within a classroom. Then I did that within marketing, opening restaurants, and utilized it in this way of being able to see like, wow, if I know that someone is at a level 3, frustrated, engaged, they want to engage but they're distracted, I can come up with solutions to get them to higher levels of engagement. And then I did that with my career with Catalyst. In those events, I utilized the levels in the framework to be able to create experiences that was the 7th level, literate thinking, when personal values and beliefs align. People would leave those events and feel, again, as I mentioned, so inspired, so ignited. They felt deeply connected to the experience, which is that 7th level. That's what we're always striving for. So I did that within my career within corporate America and within, you know, again, with nonprofits from a strategic perspective with employees and external audiences. But I really wanted to get back into education. And I have found with Web3, the impact of Web3 with engagement is really powerful because I have a graphic that I can also share with the audience. But, you know, these bottom levels of engagement kind of with Web2, it really ends at around level 5, which is what's in it for me. It's transactional. I'm only going to do something you ask me because I'm getting something out of it. These higher levels of engagement, 6 and 7. 6 is around inspiring someone to set goals to make a difference. And as I mentioned, 7 is this idea of personal values and beliefs. Web3 allows for, you know, audience members to be turned into a community, to be active participants in shaping whatever that business venture is, whether they're joining a DAO or whether they're becoming community mods or whether they're owning their own insights and data, et cetera. So that is what I'm striving for with this quote unquote stealth project. And the actual product itself is working within a classroom environment, within just learning environments, digital and physical, and having children understand themselves as learners. Having children understand themselves as, what does it look like for me to engage with the world? And having them develop a profile, if you will, creating inputs at each level, what distracts them, what confuses them, what allows for them to be productive, et cetera, et cetera. And having those traits be automatically translated into a digital avatar that they will own on the blockchain. So those insights, which are, you know, in the past, however, for however long as education has existed, has been owned by teachers, by games, by digital platforms where they're learning, by parents, and the children never know themselves as learners unless something is quote unquote wrong. And my theory is there's no more standard. There's no standard of a child. And we need to have a nuanced approach to connecting with children. And children need to be able to understand themselves with how they engage with the world so that they can communicate those needs at a very early age, wherever they are within their learning journey. So that's what I'm building. And I can certainly talk about that for about 2 more hours too, but I'm not going to because we only have 30 minutes.
Yeah, so I was going to ask you more about the long-term potential of Web3 in education, because it feels like it's totally untapped at the moment. I'm starting to see some education-focused, say, startups, but it definitely feels like we're at early days. Like, where do you see things going, or, you know, where do you see the education system ending up, or would they even embrace Web3?
You know, there's a whole movement called Ed3. That's a lot of educators focus on what Web3 will look like within education. I think that, and I just had a conversation yesterday actually about the implications of AI, generative AI within the education space. So I think that we are now at a time where the future is here. I think that within our traditional education systems, we've been able to kind of push, you know, just keep kicking the can down the road of saying, oh, like we can keep doing what we're doing. And now we're seeing that the world is going to completely change for our children. Our children are going to be, the metaverse is going to be embedded in their current reality. It's not going to be this alternate reality. It's going to be integrated. And so we need to start thinking strategically about how we set our children up for success in this new world, instead of thinking that this new world, we could just remove this world from them. That's not going to be possible. So when it comes to Web3, I think that right now we're talking about it as this separate entity. I think everything's just going to be embedded and a part of, again, a part of the experience. But the biggest implication that I feel that Web3 can have on education is twofold. One, I think, as I mentioned, that seventh level, personal values and beliefs align, we need to empower children to see themselves as having control over their own narrative and their own life, which means giving them the ability to own their own identity. And what that means on the blockchain is being able to own their own data. That in itself is so powerful from a psychological perspective, in terms of being able to also, through metacognition, being able to analyze, who am I? What is important to me? How do I learn? And then being able to own that just in itself, even if they do nothing else with it except for that process, I think will be incredibly impactful. But you know, right now, so when we graduated from college, in the States at least, universities own our transcripts. And when we go to apply for a job, the university then has to actually send the transcript to the job and charges us every time. Now on the blockchain, through Amazon actually, you're able to own your own transcript. And you're then able to utilize that transcript however you see fit. And because the blockchain is traceable, you can actually look back and see that the university sent me my transcript. So I'm not making it up. I'm not, you know, Photoshopping it. This is something that is legitimate that I'm then transferring. That is what's going to be possible with the blockchain education. By first giving a child their information in a school setting and allowing for us to see that it is, you know, legitimate and transferable, then we can trace that information to another learning environment. So let's say that child then starts to learn in Roblox. We can start to be able to build a quote unquote conversation, a traceable conversation of data that that child then owns about their learning across all aspects of their learning experience, wherever they are. And what I think is also really powerful about NFTs, smart art, whatever you want to call them, is this avatar they're going to own, they're not choosing it because it has cool hair. The data is embedded and visualized in this asset that they own. The data is literally, they're owning the data and they're owning an asset. So if they see that they have glasses because they're a visual learner, learner and they see another child has glasses because they're a visual learner, they feel less alone. They feel like data is not scary anymore. They can understand how to utilize that data in a way of connecting with others, sharing to their teachers, hey, I like to learn more visually. And so by being able to provide an asset that's theirs, that's not scary, that's a visual identity that has the data embedded into it, we're also starting to teach them about how to utilize data in a really impactful, effective way. And so that is, to me, there's a million use cases for Web3 in education. It's going to be endless. This is just the beginning. But just those very simple use cases, I think, are unbelievably powerful and will unlock a lot.
Yeah. And out of interest, with your own example about the digital avatars that these children will they be able to make changes?
Currently will be a year-to-year basis. They will be able to self-reflect and analyze and assess how they've changed and grown as a learner, and they will be able to then change that avatar. Eventually, there will be a toggle of sorts that they will be able to actually turn on. Think of like a widget, like a Google Chrome extension, while they're playing games within this ecosystem of learning, that will be able to automatically change that dynamic avatar. So what that would mean is, if I'm learning within Roblox and I'm learning within school, so right now, again, it's manual because I'm not building an AI toggle when everyone's terrified of AI. I need to start small in education. I need to prove that this is going to work and this is impactful and then go to the next step. But eventually it will change. It will be malleable, it will be dynamic, and it will change in an automatic fashion, not necessarily just through a manual effort. But yes, it will be changed based on the behaviors associated, not based on, again, this is something that I like. The digital asset is a manifestation of the data itself, not just based on your preferences of what looks cool.
It sounds really cool. And I'm excited for when you come out of stealth. You mentioned DAOs before, or also kind of a decentralized way of doing things. I know that me and you first met briefly on a DAO call from our next DAO, which you're part of. I was just there as a sort of a guest. And that's now become On Discourse, is the sort of decentralized media organization. But I was wondering, what's your experience been of participating in a DAO? Because I know it can sort of play out very differently. You can imagine that it might be harder to make progress if you kind of give power to everybody. So I don't know, like, would it be inefficient or has it been exciting? And, you know, like, what's the momentum been like? Yeah, what's your experience of a DAO?
I think the way DAOs currently exist, decentralized autonomous organizations, is that it's the changes that can be made are very minimal, in the sense that because there's structures in place that allow for that governance to occur. So currently, a lot of the DAOs that I'm a part of, it's based on voting mechanisms. So someone's kind of proposing it. It's a voting scheme within Discord. And, you know, even though there's some proposals that are extremely robust and require a lot of looking at, again, the rules to be able to follow to ensure that you're moving the organization forward, very similar to Zappos, it's not as collaborative, if you will, of the proposal state, because there's some of these DAOs are quite big. Or it's exactly what you mentioned. People don't really know the infrastructures to be able to put in place in order for it to not move the organization backwards, take too much time, take too much effort, not know who's doing what, you know, really be able to create structure. The reason why I love Holacracy, and Holacracy actually has an entire blog that they put out, a video series around how to use Holacracy to create a DAO, is Holacracy is based on something called tensions, which is the space between where the company is or organization is and the organization could be. And there's a whole governance protocol around how someone brings up a starting proposal to solve a tension. And it's a communicative, you know, collaborative effort. It takes a lot of work, though. So my answer is, I don't think that DAOs have really realized their potential. And I think that we're going to see a lot of different ways of operating as a DAO. And I've seen, you know, DAOs be a better version of a traditional organization or a traditional community, because there's a bit more of a say. But I'm still waiting to see, you know, stronger use cases of real infrastructure changes to make significant impact in a collaborative fashion.
And then what about On Discourse? The decentralized media organization. What's been your involvement in that? Have you got a role? What are you doing?
Yes. So, you know, I think that what Toby Daniels, who's a really good friend for the past decade, I just trust what he does. And I think, again, that's what I mean by these kind of DAO structures. Like, it's very community-based. So if you have someone that's inviting you in, this is the levels of engagement. I trust Toby. I'm not going to ask as many questions. I'm just going to be like, okay, I'll do what you kind of tell me, Toby, because I'm at a higher level of engagement with you. I'm at level 6. I'm inspired to set goals, make a difference with you. Let's go. So that's where I joined in the beginning. I'm a founding member of the platform, Our Next Discourse. And and I'm a founding member of the DAO. And my involvement within the DAO has been really learning a lot about Web3, bringing in speakers, you know, collaborating with other DAO members. And that's been awesome because that's a lot of the communities that I'm a part of, but I'm tired. I'm a mom of two. I'm not going to conferences anymore. I'm not flying all over. So having this weekly gathering and experience where I know I could go to anyone within this group and ask them questions or get on a call with them, and they're way more keen to work with me. That in itself is very valuable. Mm. With Arnex Discourse, I write for Arnex Discourse. I've, again, brought other individuals to write for Arnex Discourse. I've kind of helped develop strategies for the platform. And I think that, and I've had multiple calls with Toby to collaborate on what the venture looks like. And I'm a partner. I'm an actual equity partner in the platform itself. So that is a really awesome, again, use case, if you will, of being a part of a DAO. They didn't know what they were going to build, but having collaboration from the members to determine, okay, what does this look like? What does this feel like? What are the topics that we're sharing? And having the members in the DAO be a support structure for that platform. So I'm a founding member in the DAO and the platform, and I'm involved pretty much as I think I want to be involved. But if Toby doesn't hear from me, he reaches out to me and he says, this is what we need. Please support. So it's twofold.
A side note, Toby Daniels, so he was the sort of creator of this DAO, and he previously was the founder of Social Media Week, which is a series of global conferences about social media, and he sold that to Adweek, the publication. So he's a man who knows what he's talking about.
Exactly. You gotta trust Toby Daniels. That's the way to do it.
Is there anything else that you've spotted in the world of Web3 that you think is, again, a sort of untapped potential, or like interested to see where it goes, or when people sort of catch up to its potential?
Yes, I think it goes again to these levels of engagement. IP, I think, is going to be groundbreaking in as it pertains to identity and connection to brands, and being able to shape your own narrative as it pertains to that relationship. And I'm using the word brands very lightly, anything and everything. So, for me, even with these avatars, by giving IP to the children and having them own those insights, but also own the asset, they can create stories with that asset. They can create animated videos with that asset. They can create whatever, they can create a brand with that asset. Whatever they want to do with that asset, it becomes theirs. And when you think of the implications when it comes to, a movie franchise, like what's the next Marvel? What's the next comic book that's going to be owned by the community? And how is the community going to tell the stories of these characters and make those characters more valuable by wearing it, by sharing it, by connecting with it? That is unbelievably powerful as it pertains to these, again, levels of engagement. I always go back to the levels of engagement because I feel like Web3, we have a big level two problem, which is confused by the messaging on systematic engagement, where we have so much, you had a question about jargon, like technical jargon, like NFT, Web3, blockchain, asynchronous, DAO, all these things where it's like, what is anyone talking about? And when we can just remove all of those layers and say, we are going to reach a person at a higher level of connection because of X, Y, and Z, and this is how, and this is why, and this is the implications of that, it just becomes more streamlined and easy to understand. Like, okay, yeah, that makes sense. Like, you're giving people more freedom to connect and use an asset and do whatever they want with it. Obviously, that's going to be a higher level of engagement than passively consuming whatever you put out and only having the brand or the company benefit from it. So that's my last take on Web3.
I love it. This has been such a great conversation and quite sort of wide ranging. And we only were briefly sabotaged by each of our sets of children and animals.
It's true.
But lastly, Amanda, where can people find you?
LinkedIn is where I'm mostly, but they can find me on amandaslavin.com and they can email me through that. But yeah, LinkedIn is the number one. That all other social platforms give me anxiety.
I'll be sure to mention that in the show notes. Thank you so much for your time, Amanda.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Women of Web3 podcast. If you like this episode, please do give us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from. It really helps more people find the show. Check out our website, womenofweb3.co, to find our talent collective you can apply to be part of, or post your Web3 vacancies on our jobs board. If you've got any questions or comments, just tweet us at womenofweb3co, and we'll see you next Thursday morning.